Yeah.
So Boeing originally came in with the two
right.
tank thing.
And I think it was also the basic thinking of our people here. They wanted to keep it simple.
And if you get into a common bulkhead, you got very tricky wells on that diameter and so on. Is that one of the big reasons there too?
Yeah.
Okay. Because it's, you know, looking at the Saturn stack, the other, the S2 and the S4, S4B all had the common bulkhead,
mm-hmm.
so you wonder why they...
And that gave us a lot of headaches, yeah.
Yes, it did, yeah. Especially
and,
the LH2 and the lock so close together.
Yeah. And there, again, you could do it since hydrogen is, of course, so awfully light, and hydrogen is normally in the upper tank, yeah?
Right.
So the weight you have to carry is not all that heavy.
That's another thing. I confess that here my layman's knowledge kind of gets pretty hazy. But if we're talking now, as I remember, too, one of the questions that came up, why not go with LH2 and S1C? But because of the specific gravity of liquid hydrogen...
It would have been a huge tank,
huge
the
tank
would have been even bigger. We would have had to use a bigger diameter, and the diameter was one of the considerations. And I think the prime consideration was really the engine. There was not an 1.5 million pound or around there engine in existence, yeah? People worked on it, I think it was the M1.
Yeah.
But it was in real, real early phases, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And there was no hardware in existence, and there was certainly no chance to get it ever done in time. So that was completely ruled out.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And that was considered later again as a possible stage for the S2. But even these plans never came about.
Again, so it comes back to the theme, it seems to me, and that's using as much as possible existing hardware, at least hardware that's pretty far down the
mm-hmm.
Development line,
mm-hmm.
and that means the F1,
mm-hmm.
so that's what you go with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. The next thing I've got here...
I think that was a requirement for all the contractors, so no one used another engine. Yeah. They all
right.
used the F1 engine because it was really the only one we had. And that also, again, and fortunately, of course, we had already some experience with clustering. Yeah. That really required for clustering because we knew with just one F1 engine, 1.5 million pound thrust, you could never get the booster off the ground. Yeah? So we had to have something like that. And by the time the clustering principle had been sold, you probably know there were a lot of people who were against the clustering concept.
Yeah, well, okay.
Some people thought it just couldn't be done.
Within Marshall?
No, not so much within Marshall, more in headquarters, yeah. That's an area where we got a lot of static from headquarters and even some other NASA centers.
Clustering the 5F1, they didn't think it could be done.
Well, at that time, as I said, the issue was kind of dead, yeah. But it was particularly a big issue for the S1, for the Saturn 1 stage.
Okay, why didn't they think it would work? Because of they thought they could never get all five engines
right,
to ignite at the
to
same
get
time.
Them all ignited at the same time. Get them all started, and we still had lots of problems with engines. People felt if you had particular 8 engines, yeah, you always had one that didn't work.
Yeah. Yeah.
And for that reason, some people even finally worked it into an advantage, yeah, since you could fly the Saturn 1 booster, at least for certain missions, with only 7 engines on. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you could say, well, even if one of them doesn't do it, you can still, you probably wouldn't have taken off, yeah. So if it happens at takeoff, you probably would have shut off and would have fixed your engine and then planned for another launch. But if something would have happened during flight, yeah, you certainly could have continued.
Yeah. There's another thing that strikes me, why there might have been opposition, is when you have those, there were 9 tanks all together?
Yeah, 8 outside and 1 center tank.
That's pretty kind of a problem then in making sure that the propellant drain is equalized all the way around, so you
mm-hmm.
don't get all kinds of perturbations in the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a design headache?
It never turned out to be a problem. I'm sure the designers addressed themselves quite a bit to that question, yeah. But we never had any problem with it.
Was there a computer control on that, or how? Or was it just
no,
a
if you
thing
if you just
just a, just
if you just connect all the lines, yeah, particularly since you are defect that during flight goes up quite a bit. Of course, any extra column weighs an awful lot, yeah? So then that higher column, if one tank didn't empty quite as fast as the others, weighs so much more that it pushes that tank out faster. So if one tank lags behind, it automatically picks up again. So you really have to combine all the lines properly. And of course, that's where the design work goes in, yeah? You have to see to it that you don't have much higher resistance in one of the lines. And that's where the designers really have to watch out. And they did quite a bit of work in making a proper layout of the lines and the valves. The valves are even much more critical than the lines.
Why are the valves so critical? Well, because opening, you mean precise opening,
right,
and closing.
Yeah, and that they give enough cross-section, yeah? Normally in the valve, you make it a little bit smaller than the line that leads into it, yeah? Because the valve is expensive, yeah? And you want to save cost.
Yeah.
So you normally have a higher flow rate through your valve.
Yeah.
So that's really the limiting factor, yeah?
Yeah?
And if that's not properly designed, then that's where you might have problem. And of course, your valve could even close, yeah?
Yeah, I've forgotten now the opposition to cluster. I remember Von Braun referring to people who didn't like it when it was first lit out here. They were talking about cluster's last stand.
Yeah.
And the fact that the whole thing might go up or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a real big issue. And, well, I think our people never really had any great problems with it. So they always thought it is something that could be accomplished. They thought it was the right approach, particularly if you wanted to get the program quickly underway. Yeah. So if you didn't want to develop a new engine, that would have been the only other alternative.
Yeah, I had some questions if it's possible to make some generalizations about the design style or approach of the S1C, the S2, and the S4B, and I guess we've only talked about this a little bit. We said that North American was a little bit more adventurous than Boeing, for example. Why was that? Do you have any, was it because of North American's prior ventures into the X-15 program?
Yeah,
the B-70?
Right.
They were kind of
a
little bit
further
out.
They had quite a bit of experience on the one side, yeah. And they probably also had more other advanced programs in mind, other things where this might possibly be employed after the Apollo program, yeah? And of course, you always want to have the very latest design in such a case, yeah? While Boeing, I think they looked at it more as just one job to be done for the Apollo, for the lunar landing project.
Yeah. I see. How about Douglas? Did they striking midway between North American and Boeing?
They are probably a little bit closer to North American, yeah, but they are in a way midway, I would say, in between the two, but maybe leaning a little bit closer to North American.
This interests me, I don't know why, but it strikes me. I wonder if it's because Boeing and Douglas were involved more with commercial airliners, and there might be, because of the passenger factor, an inherent conservatism involved in their design style and design approach, whereas North Americans always been deep into hotshot fighters and high performance things.
And you certainly also have, at least in general terms, a reflection of this situation in their basic design approaches.
Yeah.
I would say so.
Okay. Now some questions about management. And one of the things that struck me in 1963, when they created the industrial operations and the research and development operations, Widener became head of R&DO. But when they were out looking for a guy from IO, instead of getting somebody within Marshall or one of the veterans from the days of Peenemunde and ABMA and so on, they went outside and got this guy, Young. What was the rationale behind that?
Well, I think a lot of that was also really the push from headquarters, yeah? Headquarters just didn't believe too much in our management capabilities. And don't forget, when we formed this local team here, we really didn't have any management expertise at all that had to be built up when we split away from ABMA, because basically the management was done by the Army up to that point. So it was a relatively new team. We never had been previously involved too much in real top-level management of all these things. That was army furnished. Mm-hmm. And so even the small staff that had been built up was, in a way, still relatively inexperienced. Yeah, they had gathered all their experience here on this team. Mm-hmm. And so I think headquarters, and I'm sure von Braun basically agreed with them, felt that someone should be brought in from the outside who had this experience over many years.
I've forgotten where Young was from.
He was from Aerojet.
And so he was a guy who had experience then on the outside as a civilian contractor, mm-hmm. and had managerial experience. But he only lasted a year, if mm-hmm. I recall. Was there a problem there? Or what?
Well, I think Young really didn't see, of course, the government operation is quite different than private industry operation. Yeah, in private industry, he was a big boss, and when he said, that's the way we do it, that's the way it was done. Yeah. But here, he still had to go up to headquarters, and if he thought he had a good idea, he still had to get somebody else's permission, and I think he didn't go too much for that. Mm-hmm. And also, Bob Young is basically a Californian. I think he never really liked to come to Huntsville, and he never really became settled and established here. Yeah.
Okay, that fits too, because as I recall, there was some question about bringing his family out here. Apparently, his family was really dragging their feet. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, they never really came out here permanently. I think his wife lived here for a while, probably in a rented house or so.
Yeah.
But he really never got established. And I think he also, again, he came from private industry, and of course he had a much more paternal system there than we had here. I think we had here from the very beginning always a much more democratic system. Also from Brown, he doesn't mind at all if somebody tells him you are wrong and I don't agree with you, yeah? But that's the kind of thing you apparently don't do in private industry, and I think Bob Young didn't like that there were too many people who spoke up and told him that he was wrong, yeah?
Yeah.
He was just not used to it.
So, you know, what you say is really, that explains a little bit why O'Connor might have had more success then, because...
Yeah, I think he was a little bit more open-minded, and he was a little bit more willing to listen, yeah?
And as an Air Force type, he had more experience in the ways of government bureaucracy.
And he knew that he was not the final boss. He just could make recommendations, And they better be good, then they will be accepted.
Was there, in terms of building up this managerial expertise, was there a significant impact on Marshall from the Air Force style of things? Not only through O'Connor, but even from...
We, of course, also got a lot of people assigned from headquarters,
Phillips, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
In headquarters, but also there are other Air Force mm-hmm. types here. Did they have a significant impact? Or?
Well, some of them are still around, yeah. Like Murphy, who is now in charge of PD, he really came with this. I think he came through Phillips.
Yeah.
I think he didn't come through... O'Connor, on the other hand, I may be mistaken. And it's probably very difficult to say, anyway, through which channel he came, But he's certainly an old Air Force man.
If you look at the military types that come into managerial posts, were there more from the Air Force, do you think, as opposed
the
to
the Air Force
Army?
Was much stronger than the Army, for example.
But it looked like, since you came from Admin, from the Army, there would have been more Army types coming in.
Mm-hmm.
Why was that? Do you have any... idea?
Of course, the Air Force had many more missions in that area. Yeah, the Air Force had all the big space missions, and for the Army, they had a few little artillery type boosters. Like the Pershing. So it's a completely different. The scale is at least by a factor of 10 different, I would say.
Okay, and another gross generalization. Maybe the Army too was working more in solid propellant at that time.
Yeah.
The Air Force had been more in liquid propellant.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's another consideration.
Okay, so then...
Maybe the only key man is Molea, I know of, yeah?
Pardon?
Molea. Ed Molea is the only Army man I know of.
Mm-hmm.
Well, no, there is one other. There is... can't even think of his name right now. He was even from Brown's boss at some time. And he is still with us. I think his name is also Ed. Of his name, and you might not even have met him because he is a very he disappears with all the other guys in the woodwork somewhere. Yeah. But he's a very Etea. No? He was from Brownsport in the old army days. Yeah. And he's still with us.
Did you write his name down for me? I'm gonna try and look him. What about, no, was Lee James? He was in the Air Force.
Lee James is another one. I hadn't thought of him, yeah.
Was he Air Force or Army?
No, he was Army.
Army,
yeah.
Okay.
He was with the Medeiros team, really, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Before Medeiros with Nicholson. Mm-hmm. Nickerson, yeah. Etea, boy, what's his first name again? I said Ed, but I think Ed is wrong. Well, there's only one Etea in the phone book, I'm sure,
yeah. Marshall Directory,
yeah.
Okay, I appreciate this help in the management, really, because it always, this strange balance of Air Force versus Army mm-hmm. managers in the thing, and this question with young men. How did Widener wind up as head of R&DO? It was because that maybe Von Braun, because he was working with the labs, and the labs had been pretty much
it would have been very difficult to pick any of the lab chiefs and make him the boss now of his own lab and all the other labs at the same time, yeah? Mm-hmm. So it had to be someone who was a little bit more in a neutral position, and Widener just happened to be that guy, yeah? Mm-hmm. I think he was deputy in PNVE at the time when he was selected, mm-hmm. or at least he had a second role, yeah? Mm-hmm. And he was in a way acceptable to all the others, and I think von Braun made in a way a very wise choice, yeah? And also, Widener has a really good background. He has a really good overall background. He was quite active in testing, so he had some practical experience. And he was not, in that sense, a long-haired type of scientist that many others were, yeah? So in that sense, I think he was more management-oriented than many of the other lab chiefs. So I think it was a really good choice. And in a way, I think von Braun also picked someone who was really acceptable to all the others, because all the others, of course, had to recognize him as boss. Mm-hmm. And I think Widener's most difficult thing, I don't know if you have talked to him or still plan to talk to him.
I think that John might have had him, John Belts might have had mm-hmm. him with him. I haven't talked to him.
Yeah, he's right now, of course, even in Germany, yeah?
I didn't know.
So he's not even in Huntsville anymore. Yeah. He may show up briefly because I don't think he has sold his house, yeah? Mm-hmm. On the other hand, he sells his house to someone in Germany anyway, yeah? So they can probably make all the transactions over there. Okay.
So another thing is that whereas Young was brought in from the outside, it was Widener had been working with the group since Pima
mm-hmm.
days, so
mm-hmm.
he was aware of the personalities mm-hmm. of the other lab chiefs and the needs that work with. Would that have been another consideration, you think, involved here?
Of course, someone in that position had really to know much more, because Widener was really the guy to work with the inside team, yeah?
Yeah.
And Young's position was much more to work with the outside, yeah?
Right.
I think also they brought someone in from the outside and certainly didn't want to use one of the old von Braun team, one of the old German people, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
To work with American industry. That was always a little bit, I think you know what I mean, yeah?
Right.
I don't find the right word for this kind of approach, yeah?
Mm-hmm. I think, yeah, there was always...
But there was always a little bit resentment,
yeah?
Yeah.
Right.
And I think that even went even through the last few years, just before the Apollo landing, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it was an American project, and really Americans wanted to be sure that Americans were at least the key people in charge, yeah? That some other people also helped a little bit here and there, that was all right, yeah? But to really be in top level charge, that had to be some Americans, yeah? So that was another consideration, that they much more looked for someone from the outside for that position than for the inner, internal arrangements. And also it was not quite as necessary for Young or O'Connor later to be that familiar with the inner workings. So that could be done by someone who, in a way, knows American industry better, yeah? I think there was another consideration. Our people really were not that familiar with American industry. And they wanted to have someone who really knew the ins and outs, who was well versed in contract management and all these things, yeah. Mm-hmm. And our people really had never done that before,
again,
except on a real small scale, yeah.
Going back to the ABMA days, as you say, there was another layer of
that was all done by the Army, and we really had nothing to do with it, yeah.
There's a gap, too, in my understanding of management of Marshall in the years before 1963, before we had the IO on one side and the IMDO on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
I can understand that better. But how were the decisions made prior to that? Did Von Braun have an executive group? Were there board meetings, the lab chiefs that made decisions? Or who were the decision makers?
There was even until very late in the game, they just called it the staff. There was a staff meeting, or staff board meeting. Yeah, a board. There was a development board, you are right. So there was a staff and board meeting. And a lot of decisions were, let's say, certainly being kicked around. I think we have to give from our own credit that he still made always a final decision, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
But he was a guy who really could listen to a lot of advice. And he didn't mind at all. In fact, he appreciated it if somebody told him you are wrong and that's not the kind of approach we should take. Yeah, something that lots of other people don't like. Yeah, but von Braun certainly could take it, and he even searched for it. Yeah, he wanted to get inputs so that the devil's advocate was played early in the game and not after it was too late. Yeah, and after big mistakes had been made.
Well, who were the members of the board then?
Basically, the lab directors. The lab directors and a few of the key staff officers, like the planning office, like his deputy, Rees, of course, was always on there, yeah.
And so this would have been the same people even before.
And then we had, in the early years, we had the Setup Systems Office. You are fully aware of that,
right,
yeah. And they, of course, were on the board, yeah. And we had some other projects at least under consideration, so these project managers were also on. But the bulk, we had, I think, 10 laboratories at that time. Yeah. The bulk were the 10 lab chiefs,
mm-hmm.
and von Braun's immediate direct staff.
Yeah. Were you one of the people who sat in on these board meetings
at
the time then? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the style on before 1963 and even afterwards.
It still continued for quite some time, and then later on, of course, Weidner even continued it for just R&D, yeah? It was then an R&D staff and board meeting, so he continued that scheme, and I think he had pretty regularly monthly meetings.
Did Connor O'Connor do the same thing on the other side?
Not quite as much. He had more meetings with headquarters, yeah? Of course, he was called up to headquarters all the time, and he very often went with his staff, yeah? Now, every once in a while, of course, also the headquarters people came here, and then the meeting was at this place, yeah? But I think he had more really a small staff meeting. Of course, he met fairly regularly with his own staff, and I even think he had weekly staff meetings where his own staff came together, but none of the internal people, none of our lab chiefs were involved there, except when in their lab there was a special problem, then they were specially invited, yeah?
Right.
To report about it and to decide or to say what they were going to do to overcome the problem.
What you said about, you know, the R&D being kind of the inside group in a sense, and
mm-hmm.
IO being the outside group, is really helpful to me. Maybe it's obvious, but I've never really thought of it before.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it really helps to get a better handle on it now. And so, but von Braun then could very easily decide.
And of course, the inside group was also technical consultant to the IO group, yeah?
Right.
So whenever IO had a technical problem, then they came to this group, and then they, of course, became deeply involved in one specific problem, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Not in the management of the whole thing, but to look into this one problem, to make recommendations what should be done to straighten it out. And then, of course, IO again was the one to implement it by means of contractual changes.
Well, that really gave IO then specific things that fantastic amount of expertise just to cut all those labs.
And I even think that's one of the reasons that the boosters were in the long run so successful, yeah? Because besides this being called upon whenever there was a very obvious problem, R&D has also the automatic responsibility, and I'm sure you have somewhere run into the term that von Braun used quite a bit, the automatic responsibility. With that he meant whenever any of the R&D people saw a problem somewhere and they felt the wrong approach was taken, they were obligated to speak up. They were not obligated, they were not allowed to sit in the corner and to wait until something went wrong and then say, I told you so. It was their responsibility. Yeah, that's what von Braun referred to as automatic responsibility. And a number of memos were written on that. I'm surprised that you don't know about it.
No?
No. It was played down later, yeah, because particularly Young, and maybe that was one of the reasons where Young took a little bit issue with our whole management scheme here. He didn't believe in this automatic responsibility. Yeah.
Yeah, it could really be, okay, it could really bug a guy if he wasn't prepared for
But our R&D people, and that's probably also the area where we had most of the problems between R&D and IO, because these people felt responsible. And now instead of speaking up, and that's really all von Braun had given them, they should speak up. But sometimes they, of course, moved out and did something, yeah? And that, of course, was, well, it changed the contract, it changed the cost, yeah? And that's, of course, where then people like Young and later on O'Connor and James took issue. I think probably the one who was most outspoken in that area was James, yeah?
Really?
And he said, boy, that just doesn't happen. Whenever that thing is the case, okay, we are willing to listen to you. But the final decision, if we do change the contract or not, that is our decision in I.O., yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of wonder that you had never heard about it and had not run into it.
No, I really hadn't.
Seem to recall several memos, not a very large number, but several memos where it was expressed.
So a lot of ways.
I even think James wrote it up in his report.
Could be. I've got to go. It's been some time since I've been here.
I've got to plow
through it again because I got that report really rather late after I finished some of my work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, why don't you look into James' report? I think he makes a reference and he also quotes the proper references. Yeah, so
okay,
that you
good.
Can
make sure
find out what kind of memos were written on that subject.
Good.
But I thought it was a very strong tool, and again, I think it's a very good, very clever management tool. Yeah. Although the people don't have the final authority.
Right.
But they still feel obligated, and I think our group felt obligated, and of course sometimes they spoke up and somebody else, people in IO or the contractors, didn't like it, yeah?
But yeah, there seems to me though there's also, it has to be a certain responsibility on the side of IO to make sure that they keep feeding reports and test results automatically.
Well, I think that was the case. That
happened
pretty automatically. On the other hand, of course, very often it was so much stuff to read that certainly not everyone in R&D read all the reports, yeah?
Yeah.
And you could easily overlook something which was basically very important, yeah? For that reason, again, our people always like to travel, they like to go to the contractor and to discuss with the people firsthand what really are your problems, how do you see it, yeah? So I'm sure they didn't completely depend on reports, although a lot of report reading was also being done.
Well, this is consistent, too, with what I think von Braun once referred to as the dirty hand approach.
Yeah.
Everybody got to get out there and get your hands on the hardware.
Right.
See what's happening.
And von Braun encouraged it. Yeah, he certainly didn't stop the people to go out. And travel money was not a big issue in those days. Yeah. Today, probably the people just wouldn't get their travel funds and couldn't go there anyway.
Yeah.
And of course, I.O. was very often quite a bit concerned about this kind of approach. Yeah.
Because they kept getting mixed up with the other people.
Yeah. And the contractor very often didn't know, well, what this guy now told me, is that now a contractual change, or should I just go on with my old merry way and do business as usual? So it created a number of problems, yeah. And as I said, particularly James, of course, when James stepped in, the basic development had been done, yeah. And James could afford it. As long as the development still had to be completed, I think this other approach was better, and even if it runs over the contract a little bit, but you still really want to have a functioning and working item, yeah? That you get it at the very lowest possible prices of really of second importance. Because something which is a little bit cheaper but doesn't do the job doesn't help you at all, yeah? It's just like our war in Vietnam. We probably fought the most efficient, most cost-effective war, but after all, we lost it, yeah?
there's another thing that maybe you can really help me out with, and this is very vague to me, and this is the integration and overall systems review efforts of GE and Bell and Boeing. And I really don't know what all this involved. I just know there was something like that. Can you help me out on that?
Because our people never believed in it.
Yeah, I know. Yeah,
so
I
we
know
thought it was all for the birds and it was just a waste of taxpayers' money.
Yeah.
And GE was really brought in from headquarters. Yeah, that was where really Shea for the first time came in before he took over in Houston and finally the Apollo management. Yeah. But he was initially a headquarters guy, and I even think he came initially from GE. He was certainly an electrical engineer,
yeah,
or electronics engineer. And I think he was at some time at GE. Or maybe he had just some good buddies at GE, like Sloan. I think Sloan was one of the guys who really wanted to do this overall integration. And they just felt that the people here couldn't do it. And particularly, and I think everyone admits, the integration between our center and Houston was always a little bit difficult, yeah? So I think that was even their main concern. They were not so much concerned that we couldn't integrate all our boosters with each other, although there was a little bit of that also, yeah? But the main concern was really, how can we really integrate the two?